First argued case this morning is number 13-5103, Lifton against the United States. Mr. Stroud. Yes, proceed.
Good morning. Jonathan Strauss on behalf of the plaintiff appellant. May it please the court. The Court of Federal Claims was correct regarding approximately 90 to 95% of its decision. It, however, erred regarding the last small part of its opinion, which concluded that a component of Mr. Dadakis' advice was not substantive and therefore did not amount to reasonable cause with respect to the delay in filing the estate tax return. I'm going to focus today on a very, very small, narrow, discrete portion of the Court of Federal Claims opinion.
Can I ask you something before you get
sure.
to the issue that you've actually raised? I had understood from the papers that you all actually did pay into the IRS more than the amount ultimately due and did so within the retroactively extended time for payment. And if that's right, and you'll tell me if it is, why is there any penalty due since you multiply 5% times the net due?
We're asking the same question, Your Honor. We don't believe that there should be a penalty due.
Have you raised that issue here?
I don't believe we raised that issue here.
The statute, excuse me for interrupting, but to pursue this very point, the statute is section 6651B1. You know which statute I'm referring to?
Yes, this A1 and A2 is the relevant statute.
Okay. You mentioned it, but haven't apparently relied on it. It's hard to tell. But you're not saying as a matter of statutory interpretation the point that Judge Toronto has mentioned is not before us?
I think we broadly discussed 6651A in our briefs, Judge. But
I guess this is really a point. I think as in B, where A says 5% times the amount that the tax, which I forget the exact language, the amount that you're supposed to show on the return.
Right.
And then B says that amount is actually, you're supposed to subtract anything that you did pay before the prescribed time. As I understand it, you actually paid more than the $800-something thousand in January. In February of 2004, you retroactively got the extension on the due date of payment, which had been December. So how is it that when you apply B and subtract the amount that you paid, there's anything to multiply 5% by? Probably more to be discussed with the IRS, but I'm sort of mystified why there's a dollar amount involved here.
Raising the issue, I am also mystified. If there is an error in a computation such as this, the IRS is empowered, obviously, to go back and correct that error. And that's done after the fact.
The answer is, isn't it, that the IRS views, has interpreted that provision as only applying to payments that are made before the original due date as opposed to payments that are made before the extended date?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. Generally, penalties are computed based on an outstanding amount due.
I believe that the IRS has interpreted that provision as being limited to payments that are made before the original due date, which this payment was not made, right? It was not made before the original due date.
The payment was made after
December. It was made in January, and the original due date was December.
The original due date was December 2nd, 2003. There was an extension requested of 6 months, and it was granted through June 2nd, 2004, and the payment was made on January 20th, approximately 2003.
Yeah, so after the original due date.
So
you're not objecting to the interpretation of B1? It says the penalty on the net amount that they include and the net amount due, the amount that was already paid.
When you say we're not objecting, I guess if there's a computational error, Your Honor, the only way I can answer that is that we believe that the IRS would be wrong with respect to its assessment of the penalty that should be abated in full. If there's a mathematical computation, that's wrong.
But you haven't raised that.
Again, we raised 6651 broadly in our briefs, but we didn't zero in on that particular argument. You're correct. So what I was beginning to say was that the record shows that Mr. Dadakis put the IRS on notice when he sent a letter to them explaining that he was relying on the statutory construction as well as the regulatory framework for filing the return late, and the IRS never got back to him. Never wrote back, never communicated with him at all.
Let's take a hypothetical.
So sure.
Suppose, forget about the merit reduction aspect of this thing, which the Court of Federal Claims ruled in your favor on. Suppose the only issue here had been he'd run out of extensions, there was a due date, and the advice was, you don't have to file on time because until you're satisfied that you've computed everything correctly. Would that be sufficient to eliminate the penalty, that kind of advice?
In 99% of the cases, no. In this case, the 1%, there was no guidance for Mr. Dadakis to provide his advice for. The statute and the regulation said that you could file the return late, and then after you were in legal no man's land, there was no deadline, there was nothing. The statute and the regulation contemplate that you can wait until the spouse becomes naturalized. That here took a year or two, and ultimately he was in no man's land as far as when the ultimate deadline was. There was no unambiguous deadline. Boyle, the Supreme Court has said there has to be an unambiguous deadline, and if there's an unambiguous deadline, you're out of luck. If you file late, that's it.
But the advice that the Court of Federal Claims found to be reasonable was that you could wait until the naturalization occurred.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So that advice only carried you through the date of the naturalization.
Correct. And our position is that you were in legal no man's land at that point. You didn't have a deadline anymore. So once you don't have a deadline...
Well, you did have a deadline. The advice was you could wait until naturalization. Didn't that suggest that once naturalization occurred, there was an obligation to file?
Well, there was an obligation to file, but then they still couldn't liquidate the marital deduction, which was the very purpose for trying to get naturalized.
What do you mean liquidate?
They couldn't figure out what the exact amount was because they were still litigating with the surviving spouse. And as the record states, Joint Exhibit... in some of the exhibits, the attorney for the surviving spouse was gone for extended periods of time in Mr. Dadakis's declaration, and it dragged on for another 6 months approximately. Then they ultimately were able to figure out what the ultimate marital deduction was because they were still litigating with her, and she had a claim.
There's no basis in the code for waiting to file a return because you're worried about computational issues. You file and then you worry about the computations later, right?
If there's an unambiguous deadline. Here there was no unambiguous deadline. That's the whole point here. That's what we're putting all of our eggs in that basket, Your Honor. Our basket is that if there's no unambiguous deadline, we didn't have any guidance as to what the filing deadline was. So we were litigating with her even after she became naturalized. We ultimately, with haste, and that's what Mr. Dadakis's declaration states, pulled together the relevant numbers and filed the return. We were in an overpayment situation. There was no clear statute. There was no case law. There was no authority whatsoever in this situation to guide Mr. Dadakis or the executor as to what the deadline was, period. In a normal case where, you know, an advisor says, you can wait until after April 15th or, you know, take a crack at filing this. There's an unambiguous deadline. Here there was no deadline. The regulation contemplated filing late. So Mr. Dadakis looked at all this information and after all the smoke cleared, told his client that you can file late.
Well, it sounds though you're saying any time there's a legal advice that gives you a basis for extending the deadline, there's never a deadline anymore and you can never be held to a penalty for failing to file.
I agree with you. Again, like I said, we're putting our eggs in the basket that Boyle says that you have to have an unambiguous deadline. If it's unambiguous, you can't delegate the duty to file late.
What I don't hear you say is that Well, let's say they filed late, but that it wasn't as if they filed 10 years late. They filed late with an excuse.
Correct.
I don't hear you say that because the government already had $100,000 more than they agreed they were entitled to, it doesn't, as far as the penalty is concerned, that the monetary penalty shouldn't apply. And again, going back to B1, which refers to A1, which can be read perhaps ambiguously, but can be read to, I think, to say that, that the penalty is based on the unpaid tax. And there was no unpaid tax. It was overpaid tax. But I couldn't find that argument pressed. You sort of gloss over it. Is that because you don't think it's viable under the statute?
I think if, as the court raises it, I think it is viable. But what I guess I'm saying is that I always thought when we were drafting these briefs that, number one, the equities pointed towards the taxpayer.
Well, you mean the advice of counsel?
Exactly, exactly. But also, if you're in an overpayment situation, no harm, no foul, the regulation in the statute allowed Mr. Dadakis to provide the advice that, you know, you could file late. Everybody knew you were going to file late. He put the IRS on notice that he was filing late. The IRS never responded to him. And, you know, after all the smoke clears, we believe that the penalty should be abated in full.
Maybe let's hear from the government.
We'll sure.
Your time for further questions.
Thank you very much.
Your Honors, may it please the court. I'm John Millett, and I represent the United States. And I see that I need to address right away that the IRS does use the mechanics and methodology of computing the penalty. Assuming that, not assuming, but by law, and we would cite to you section 6151C, that a time for filing is fixed on the original due date.
But isn't so that, it curious? Here someone has prepaid, overpaid the tax by a sizable amount. So the government has the money, has the use of the money and all else, and what with this and that, for good reason or not, files the piece of paper later. Nonetheless, you hit them for 25% of the entire tax.
I understand.
No,
the penalty is
so
quite stiff. And
so it isn't 25% of the tax due, according to the statute. That tax was already paid and prepaid.
Yes, and yet Congress seemed to want to incentivize and strongly encourage timely filing, and it is a stiff penalty in this particular case. And I did, as I sat there, because I recalled seeing in the record, in the original refund claim that the estate filed, they actually conceded in a footnote that this is...
But can you point us to something or other, even if it requires additional briefing, say that Congress intended this result, that when there's no underpayment, and in fact a sizable overpayment, nonetheless, the 25% of the tax is due if you are delayed for good reason, when you file the piece of paper with the final calculation.
Yes, this is how the IRS is looking at the statute.
But is there a formal interpretation? I must say, we couldn't find it.
We looked and didn't find anything either
in our
search.
But
what we understand is the statute itself.
On its face?
What you're saying is that the IRS has interpreted the statute based on the other provision that you mentioned to require payment before the original due date rather than the extended due date.
Because otherwise there is no reduction under B1.
Right, but I guess, again, just from the statute, what I find peculiar about that is that in A2, which talks about paying the amount shown on any return on or before the date prescribed for payment of such tax, it immediately follows, continues by saying, determine with regard to any extension of time for payment. I would have thought that when the phrase prescribed for payment is then used in B1, it would in fact carry along the same determined with regard to extensions. But you're saying that the IRS has said, no, those are radically different things.
Yeah, the penalty for late filing is quite severe, even vis-a-vis this late payment penalty.
But how do you measure the penalty for late filing when the amount due was paid this before, overpaid. You're saying the penalty is not...
If they had made that payment, as
let
they...
Let me finish the question.
I'm sorry.
If the question is... The question is whether the penalty is levied on that which was unpaid, or whether they're entitled to a penalty on the total amount which was overpaid, which is what happened here, right? They overpaid.
They overpaid, but the payment wasn't submitted until after the due date of the return. And the way we read the statutes, and again, Section 6151 appears to address this specifically. It's 6151A says with respect to, I believe that addresses payment, and it says that the fixed date for payment without regard to any extension is the date of that the return was due.
No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Unless I'm misreading this. A2 is the one that says in case of failure to pay the amount shown as tax on any return prescribed for payment of before the date prescribed for payment of such tax. It doesn't say without regard to extension. It says determined with regard to any extension of time.
I understand the confusion, Your Honor. I'm not referring to that particular provision. I'm referring to a provision prior in the code that talks about fixed dates and what they mean within the code. So if you look at 6151, Section 6151, and that seems to be there, you look at that statute, that establishes the fixed dates wherever otherwise referred to in the code. And the way that the mechanics of calculating the penalty then would work for filing, we would agree with respect to the late payment penalty, the way that statute you just read is written, that you would reduce it by the amount paid by the extended due date. The late filing penalty, on the other hand, doesn't have that same language. It talks about a prescribed time for filing. Relating back to 6151, C, I believe it is. It tells you that the prescribed time for filing within the code is the original due date for filing. So this is why there is some confusion here. But again, I'd point out to Joint Appendix page number 306, where the estate actually concedes in a footnote that this is the mechanics for, and it actually tries to draw sympathy because they did, within 45 days after the due date of the return, submit their payment. Nevertheless, they're subject to the penalty if they don't have good cause or reasonable cause for filing late.
Could we go on and address the good cause question? I mean, it seems to me there are obviously two separate questions here. One, the legal advice relating to the marital deduction and waiting to file a return, and the second one, what they call the ancillary matters. As to the first one, the Court of Federal Claims ruled against you, and I must say I find it a little puzzling that the IRS allows the marital deduction when, at the time of the due date of the return, the requirements of naturalization haven't been satisfied. But that's neither here nor there. That's what you do. You do allow it. So it seems to me that there's a decent argument that you have to wait to get the marital deduction because if you filed on the due date, you wouldn't get it because the naturalization hadn't occurred. And that you can get it by filing late and having the naturalization occur in the interim. So why, under those circumstances, isn't there a reasonable cause for waiting to file a return to earn the marital deduction?
Well, Your Honor, we first and foremost defend the decision with regard to the last 9 months. We think in this case, the last 9 months, it's clear.
I understand. All right.
Our position on brief, and we did take that fallback position, is that if you read the regulation that correlates to the marital deduction provision allowing a non-citizen spouse to claim that the estate may claim the deduction when they become naturalized, even if late, it also quite clearly states, but nevertheless, the return is considered filed when actually filed. We would suggest that that is a rather unambiguous statement that it's late, and therefore the cost of obtaining your marital deduction in that situation is the penalty. And in this particular case, in fact, it was economically viable for the estate to proceed as it did, because even with the penalty, they made out quite a bit better than they would have than not being allowed the marital deduction. So that is our position. Again, we would rather emphasize the fact that in this particular case, and we understand that the court may not be of a mind to have to reach this other portion, this first delinquency portion. But we believe it, that it ought to affirm on the basis that the last 9 months, which at which point the maximum penalty was reached, there was just no reasonable basis for it.
What role under the statute does the reasonableness of the legal advice play in this determination? For example, suppose a lawyer told his client, don't bother paying your income tax because the income tax is unconstitutional. Presumably, you would seek a penalty under those circumstances. Is that because the advice is unreasonable?
The cases are somewhat all over the case, all over the place, and I think you could argue that that's substantive in a sense, but it's obviously so unreasonable on its face that it can't possibly be good cause or reasonable cause for not filing. And
then you'd have to go to a jury on the actual willfulness question under Cheek, right?
Yes. In the criminal context. But I've thought of this, and I think a balancing act that ought to be played in a case-by-case basis is the more sophisticated the taxpayer, the less he can rely on erroneous advice that's clearly erroneous, that's just not has very little basis in the law or no basis in the law. It may be substantive advice, but...
But is the position you retain the position that despite the fact that the result is a 25% penalty in the entirety and all of the other things we've been discussing, this was not substantive advice despite the powerful substantive consequences?
Which portion of the advice? We accept the fact that with respect to the advisor's discussion and analysis of the Merrill deduction and claiming it on a late return would be substantive, and if a less sophisticated taxpayer certainly could rely upon it. I guess our brief suggests that this particular executor, being quite an experienced attorney in his own right in financial matters, probably ought to have been able to tell on his own that a late return is going to trigger the penalty even under the regulation.
So where is the non-substantive advice that led to the imposition of this penalty?
The latter advice, that you could wait till all ancillary matters were complete. We don't find that substantive, but rather the belief by this advisor that the IRS isn't going to impose the penalty because...
So the fact that the consequence is dramatic doesn't render the advice that led to that consequence substantive? Is that the position?
Your Honor, are you suggesting that because the penalty is so harsh that it becomes more of a substantive issue? I'm not necessarily following, but...
Can I ask you just a second? Put aside the advice about you can wait until there is naturalization. At that point, as I understood Mr. Strauss's point, it was something like until certain remaining disputes were resolved, we didn't have any idea what number to put on the return. What's your response to that?
I hadn't thought that that was the case, Your Honor. I thought it was fairly clear that a pretty accurate and complete return could be completed far in advance of when it was filed. And the law is such, the regulations and the case law say that you cannot avoid the penalty by suggesting that you couldn't file a complete and accurate return when due. You can always supplement that return with the completed information, and the liability can then be readjusted.
So I guess I'm asking a very maybe mundane question. I don't know if it's mundane or not, but suppose they just didn't know what the number was. What should they have put in? Zero? Should they have put in their best guess with an asterisk saying this is just a guess, we're not lying? Or how are they supposed to do this?
Assuming that we have a different case, because in this particular case, the numbers were well assembled by that time. But if your 9 months is coming up on the original due date of the return and you think you need more time to do the accountings and get
I mean, supposing they get the one extension and then let's suppose now we're past the issue on which the Court of Federal Claims agreed with them and They see the naturalization has just occurred, and they realize, okay, my reasonable cause, again, assuming, has run out. I need to file my return. Suppose now for a minute that they don't actually know the number. What are they supposed to do?
Fill it out as completely as possible and get it in.
Best estimate.
Best estimate, is that? Or is it zero?
Yeah, I would say your best estimate based upon the numbers that you have. You should file it on time. You can supplement later. It's not reasonable cause, it seems to me, to say, well, I'll just wait till I can do it. That's an open-ended kind of filing. And Boyle instructs how imperative it is that the IRS be able to process these things promptly to determine the taxes promptly and assess the taxes promptly.
All right, so just to be clear, I understand the position of the service. It is that it's totally irrelevant that they prepaid an overpayment of what they eventually owed. Is that right?
No, I don't think that's the right way to say it, because and under the law and the way it's understood by the IRS, it wasn't prepaid. They needed to pay it before that filing due date, the original filing.
The IRS had their money, so what did they do? Do you want to give it back with interest? You say it's irrelevant that they prepaid? They apparently had competent legal advice. They had experts who told them this or that, which led to this mess, including that, said, never mind, take the position which is most favorable to the government and send them the money. So they did. And so the government had it for a couple of years before they finally straightened it out. You're saying that's irrelevant. They still have to pay the 25% penalty just as if they didn't do that.
Under the mechanics of the statute, yes, the late filing is penalized severely. I'm not saying that it's irrelevant that they would prepay, but if they had done it 45 days earlier, as they acknowledged in a footnote to their original refund claim, it would have been okay. They didn't. They just simply didn't pay it in sufficient time to avoid the late filing penalty.
Okay. Any more questions?
Can I just one more? Is there more that they could have done in 2003, early 2004, to ask the IRS, can we wait, and if so, for how long? Or is it full stop?
I expect that they might have asked for an advisory on that, some input. They did, in fact, ask for, of course, the 6-month automatic extension, which they received. But no, they relied on their counsel's advice.
Well, I know what they did. I guess it feels to me like it might be relevant.
I think there certainly are means by which, I suppose, if you're being represented by counsel, they're not cheap means, but where you could seek an advisory opinion from the service. But, of course, in the meantime, the clock's running, and those things take time. I wouldn't have hurt, I suppose,
I thought to check. I thought the regulation under the advisory opinion says something. The provision says something about sort of the clock tolling on while the advisory.
I don't know, Your Honor. Okay. I frankly don't know.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nellett.
Thank you.
Mr. Strauss.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple things, and I can try to knock this off in a couple of minutes. My colleague keeps on raising, and they brought it up in their briefs, how the executor in this case was a very sophisticated attorney. All right, he had no knowledge of any tax law whatsoever. So by them making that argument on a summary judgment motion, they're asking the court to make an inference that because he was a bright attorney and had a sophisticated background, that somehow he should not seek advice or that it negates reasonable cause. They're not allowed to make that negative inference.
I think they're only arguing it with respect to the first issue about waiting until the marital deduction was resolved. I didn't hear them making that argument with respect to the second issue about the ancillary matters.
Okay, and that's the case. I'm just saying globally they've made that argument that somehow because he's sophisticated it negates reasonable cause at some point in the process. I'm not sure if it's in the first stage or the second stage, but I just wanted to make that clear for the court. Because it's an improper inference to draw against the non-movement. All right. Number two, the court asked, what if you didn't know the number? What are you supposed to put down? And like I said, at Joint Exhibit 228, paragraph 19, Mr. Gadicus's declaration. Joint Appendix 228, even after she became naturalized in August of 2005, as I brought up earlier, they didn't know what the precise marital deduction was.
But as I understand it, from what you've said earlier, and I think you were quite candid about it, is
yes.
putting aside the marital deduction, if somebody is just uncertain about a computation, that's not an excuse for a late filing. You're saying this is special because of
correct.
The marital deduction. That's correct, right?
Correct, no. correct. I mean, this is the 1 out of 100 where there's no guidance, there's no case law, there's no regulation, there's nothing. And the executor, who was sophisticated, was solely relying on Mr. Dadicus's advice. That was the only thing that he could follow, that he could rely on. And he did. And Mr. Dadicus said, you know, even in his deposition, he said, you calculate the marital deduction, you wait for it to become naturalized, and ultimately, with haste, you know, after certain ancillary matters are finished, you file the return. I would be happy to file some supplemental brief. The court brought that up initially in the oral argument. I'd be pleased to do that if the court finds it necessary.
Well, perhaps so. There is this question, really, of the interpretation 6651 mm-hmm. through A and B. And if there is any sense somewhere of what the intention was, if it was in fact contemplated that this could result in a penalty, as here, of an entire prepaid, overpaid tax, which it looks as if was just done in the interest of some prudence to send in more than might be due to avoid penalty, perhaps. I can't tell. You didn't really press that in the argument, either side, or be interested in the view of the service as well, and as applied perhaps to the limited facts here rather than some kind of global construction, where there was a prepayment within a certain time frame, and to see if there's any guidance in the legislative record as to this interpretation, because I think we all agree the position taken by the service seems to lack equity, if anything else.
I agree.
And whether nonetheless it was intended to impose such a vigorous, without exception, penalty for failure to file a piece of paper, no matter how much overpayment is made, that for that to be the law of the land. Because if so, I think the taxpayers need to know that that's the construction that they will face.
Can I ask you a quick question that I asked Mr. Nolet? Is there more that you could have done than you did to ask the IRS how long you could wait?
I believe that a taxpayer can go in on some type of private letter ruling or something. We sent a letter to the IRS explaining our position, an outline, and that they never got back to us.
But you never requested a letter?
We didn't request a formal administrative pronouncement. Mr. Dadicus relied on the reg, he relied on the statute, and based on his interpretation, thought that, you know, the statute and the reg says you can wait. While she's becoming naturalized, you can hold off filing. And it's kind of like a simple, straightforward provision. And then it stops there, though. It's truncated because it doesn't go on to say when you have to file after that. So everybody was in legal no man's land.
Was there anything in the tax lawyer, professional literature, tax advisor, or I don't even know the range
right,
of it,
sure.
in which this question of marital deduction, timing, and the estate tax was discussed so that there was some kind of basis other than this inference from the regulation and from the Federal Register commentary in Treasury's rulemaking on this to reflect a relevant community understanding of the way this is supposed to work?
To be totally honest with you, Your Honor, I don't know if there's secondary authority that discusses the custom and practice under these circumstances. I know that there was no case law, statute, or regulation that addressed this particular issue.
Okay, now let's set a deadline for this project that we've assigned. It could turn out to be complicated and time-consuming. We didn't intend to create some multi-thousand-hour research project, but I must say it did strike us that there didn't seem to be any explanation or foresight of this possibility, which I would have thought would have gotten the attention of taxpayer associations. Is a month enough time?
That's fine with me, Your Honor.
Mr. Nolet said that they had done a little bit of searching, so perhaps if you can somehow collaborate and contribute your views to us. I don't know. It's complicated. Judge Dyke thinks a month is too long.
Okay. All right.
So we like to move the cases along when they're before us. Let's split the difference. Let's say 20 days.
That's fine, Your Honor. So what is the precise date that you're talking about?
What we were interested in is really the relationship, the statute 6651,
okay,
and how to interpret subsection B, which applies to subsection A, because it seems as if that could have a fairly direct relationship as to what the penalty is levied on.
Okay.
If there were an underpayment rather than an overpayment, I think that there's no argument that the penalty would be levied on the underpayment. To levy it on an overpayment seems curious, and I think this is an area that raised question in our mind because of the potential impact if that is to be the practice of the service.
So 20,
so 20 justice to that statute.
Okay.
Is that enough? Work.
It's a simultaneous briefs.
I think simultaneous contributions. You might collaborate to share
that would be
some of the labor.
January 30th.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
20 days from today would be January
30th.
January 30th, he's saying, is the date.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. That's a good round number.
And I would assume less is more. So would you like this limited to some page amount or? You want 10 pages or 5 pages, or what are you looking for exactly? Just for some additional guidance.
1 page.
I'm understanding what you're saying. Soon or short. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.